You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. I'd like now to welcome Ed Williams. He's a reporter with Searchlight New Mexico, and he just published an investigative story about the foster care system in New Mexico. Welcome.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thanks.
This is a tremendously troubling story, a very sad story about what's going on with foster kids in New Mexico. It starts with the story of an 11-year-old boy who was in the emergency room with signs of having been badly beaten. His foster mother said, and he said, that he tripped during soccer practice or something like that.
Yeah, that he tripped. He was practicing soccer in the front yard and tripped and bonked his head on a, they have some like decorative railroad ties in the front yard. And that was the explanation that she and the kid gave to hospital staff when they got there, which of course didn't make any sense to the doctors.
Because
the injuries to this little boy who's 11 years old were just spectacular. I mean, the police reports describe ligature marks on his neck, a patch of hair ripped from his head. His eyes were swollen so shut that he couldn't see or couldn't even latch his glasses behind his ears. He had bruises all over his body. A lot of them were the shape and size of fingers and fingertips, as if he'd been grabbed and thrown across the room. It took doctors no time at all to realize that, you know, this explanation that this kid had tripped and you know, conked his head on a piece of wood just was absolutely impossible given the injuries that he had.
And so what was the real story and how did it emerge?
It emerged pretty quickly when detectives got involved. The police reports say that the little boy was waiting in the emergency room, waiting room, with his foster mother, Hope Graciano, and a security guard walked by. And while the foster mother was distracted, the boy whispered the words, "Help me," to the security guard. That immediately tipped off hospital staff that something very suspicious was going on. And after that, you know, the doctors took the kid into the evaluation room and, like I just said, you know, found that these injuries were not consistent with the explanation given, and also he was seeming very nervous and acting suspicious, and so was the foster mother. So they called the detectives from the Farmington Police Department who came and, you know, were also easily not convinced by the explanation that the foster mother had given, and pretty quickly started an investigation into potential child abuse. So the detective on the case started doing some quick digging on the database that the police department has. There's something called a police jacket that I didn't know existed before, but basically it's if you've ever been involved in a police case before, even if you're not the suspect, say you were a witness to something, there's a record of that. The police have it. It's not the same as a police record, but they were easily able to say to see that this foster mother had been shown or suspected to be very abusive and hostile and violent in the past. And so quickly they were able to determine that, you know, there was about, the detective said he was, it took him no time at all to establish a 30-year pattern of violent abuse against her stepdaughter, other family members, long before this person had filed to become a foster parent.
So there is this huge question, which is, if the police can find that out in no time at all, how is it that the foster care system is licensing these people and paying them as foster parents?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? I mean, this is treatment foster care. Maybe we should step back really quickly and explain what kind of foster care this was. This is a type of foster care meant for kids with high needs, you know, kids with severe emotional or behavioral health needs that have been through a lot of trauma. So kids that just need more help and more, you know, families that are more trained than a typical foster family. So these are run by nonprofit, usually sometimes for-profit behavioral health companies that are supposed to give a higher level of scrutiny to who they hire. But, you know, obviously that's not happening like it should. And this company, in this case, it was La Familia Namaste, licensed the foster mother, Hope Graciano, despite, you know, just a list of warning signs as long as your arm. But it's one of those things where everyone seems to have known independently or should have known that something was wrong or something, there was reason to suspect that maybe this woman wasn't fit to be a foster parent. But somehow the dots just didn't get connected.
Now, treatment foster care, as you say, is for the kids who really need special help. What are their backgrounds generally? Are they from very abusive families, substance abuse? I mean, what are we talking about?
A lot of times they are, they're also for, in some cases, medically fragile kids, kids with health conditions that need extra, that's kind of a separate category. There's a company called ARCA who I think has, by all indications, done a pretty good job that cares for kids like that. You know, say you have cerebral palsy or something and you need extra help. But mostly they're young kids who have just been determined to have a higher level of need than a regular foster kid would. They call it high acuity in CYFD jargon. So, you know, these are just kids who might have had just an especially traumatic experience that's left them with some severe emotional issues, you know, some PTSD that's maybe stronger than other than other kids might have in the foster system, even though all foster kids, I think it's fair to say, have had some level of trauma. Or maybe kids that have some kind of violent tendencies or sexual tendencies that are, you know, that just need more supervision and more care. That's what it's supposed to be for. What's interesting is that when I talked to a lot of former foster youth and some groups that work with current foster youth, what I heard was, especially among the teenage population, almost every foster kid is in treatment foster care at some point, especially, like I said, when they're a teenager. A lot of that might be, you know, you get caught sneaking out at night, something that might be normal teenage behavior in other cases, but if you're in the foster care system, that might label you as oppositional defiant or something, and then maybe you'll get pushed up to treatment foster care.
The medicalization of adolescence.
Yeah. Ezra Spitzer, who is the director at NMCAN, they're a really great group in Albuquerque that advocates for foster kids, he put it that they're basically creating a clinical diagnosis for being a teenager.
Right.
And that causes all kinds of problems, right? Once you're in that strict, structured environment with all kinds of rules, that's what treatment foster care is, someone's always got their eyes on you. You know, there's always adult supervision, which could be a good thing in some cases, but if you're a teenager, you know, that might make you want to rebel more. And then you get sent to a residential treatment center, which is, basically an inpatient psychiatric hospital like Desert Hills. And there's a lot of questions about, you know, the consequences of putting someone in treatment foster care that doesn't need to be there.
And so then a kid ends up, and in this case that we're talking about with this 11-year-old boy, a young child, and his younger sister, who are in treatment foster care, that means they're already traumatized, and then they have this apparent psychopath as a foster mother, this is a family show, but can you talk a little bit about some of the things that this woman apparently did to these kids?
Yeah, and of course, she hasn't gone to trial yet, and she hasn't been convicted. So we can't say, you know, anything for certain at this point, except that based on the protocols and common sense, there were red flags that should have been caught and that she should not have passed muster as a foster parent. But the allegations are, there's a Child Protective Services report from 2009 that she severely abused her younger stepdaughter growing up. She wasn't the target of that investigation, but, you know, the documentation within that report clearly says that, you know, there's allegations of severe abuse against this woman. There was another little girl that was in her care before this brother and sister ended up with her as a foster parent, who was investigated by CYFD's Protective Services Division twice, I believe, for mysterious bruising. She had what looked like grab marks on her face, like, you know, bruises the shape and size of fingertips, like as if someone had grabbed her by the face and thrown her. And, you know, the explanation that Graciano gave was that this appeared to be, that she just fell off the bed and hit her head on a book, and that was why she had grab mark, you know, kind of a similar explanation as she gave with the other kid in the hospital. There was another Child Protective Services report that said that she would, you know, scream and throw things across the room with foster kids in her home. One thing that I noticed really quickly, just with a quick search of the court's database, was that she was a defendant in, I think, 9 court cases. These were debt collection cases, not cases of child abuse, but cases that CYFD said, when I talked to them, should have set off a lot of alarm bells. You know, having money problems doesn't by any means mean you're a bad person or unfit to care for kids, but it might mean that, are you in this for the money that you get paid to take in foster kids? So that calls for extra scrutiny. There's no indication that happened in this case. So those are a few of the things that police were able to find really quickly. There were also warning signs at school. One of the little girl's teachers documented over a period of months the girl coming to school with black eyes, with bruises on her face and all over her body, and being really nervous and really terrified when the foster mother would come to pick her up.
And hugging that teacher so tight and not wanting to let go.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, in the report that you wrote, there is a report that this mother, this Hope Graciano, starved the children, or at least the boy, forced him to eat his own vomit.
Yeah, it's pretty graphic.
Made him exercise till his body gave out, locked him in his room with alarms and motion detectors, beat him so badly for getting a math question wrong on his homework.
That's what the allegations are in the police reports, yeah. And there was another, that earlier Protective Services Division investigation, you know, also said that one time her stepdaughter got a math question wrong and was, you know, basically really violently punished for that. Of course, these are all investigations, not trials, you know, so.
Yeah. But these are, I mean, this is the information that we have so far. You're reporting on it. We will see how it goes forward. But what it brings up is this world in which, here in New Mexico, you've got companies, both for-profit and non-profit companies, whose job it is to screen these families. What are their responsibilities, and what do you see is happening and not happening?
Well, their responsibilities are to comply with a number of required safety checks in order to make sure that foster parents are, you know, are fit to be foster parents and are in it for the right reason. And of course, most foster parents are wonderful people who are making a great sacrifice and want to help kids. But there's always going to be, you know, some bad apples, and they're supposed to screen those bad apples out and make sure there's no history of violence, no history of abuse, no suspicious behavior or anything in the past. There's a number of state regulations that CYFD uses, a number of tools, I should say, to make sure that happens. One's called a safe home study. It's basically a really big comprehensive evaluation of the physical house, you know, everything from is there a pool with a fence around it? Is there a gun safe for the shotgun? All that kind of stuff. Two really in-depth evaluations, and I think they call them psychosocial evaluations, of the family members themselves and all of their relatives, everyone living in the house. That's one level. There are criminal background checks. The companies are supposed to do a check on the state's court's database to catch things like those debt collection cases, like I mentioned before. There are abuse and neglect checks where the companies, you know, send a referral to CYFD to make sure that this foster parent applicant hasn't come up in CYFD's system as having been reported by another person for suspected neglect. You know, that's when you call, I think it's Pound Safe, and say, I think my neighbor is yelling at their kids. So that should get flagged. But what we found was a lot of times that's not happening.
That's not happening, and yet you and I, the taxpayers, are paying, and we're paying a hefty amount. I think it said in the article $25,000 per child.
Yeah, that's a legislative finance report said that's the average cost for treatment foster care. It's the second most expensive, I think, behavioral health service for kids after residential treatment.
And so that money is going to these companies whose job it is to run these background checks and to do very comprehensive scrutiny,
mm-hmm.
and they're not doing it. Where's that money going?
Yeah, well, the ins and out of the payments, these are Medicaid companies. So they're going through, they're billing Medicaid. There should be some record of it at the Human Services Department's Medicaid office. Some of it might be directly taxpayer funded. A lot of it's just Medicaid. And then what is a direct taxpayer contribution is the usage of these safe home studies that I mentioned earlier. La Familia Namaste, the company that licensed Hope Graciano, is responsible for doing the safe home studies for all of CYFD's homes. So they got a contract from the state to basically evaluate the safety of homes and of foster families for non-treatment foster care houses across the state. And that is, I think, a direct, you know, taxpayer contract. It's about $1.6 million since 2014, I think.
And so is there oversight of these agencies? I mean, they're essentially they're government contractors, is one way of putting it. And are they overseen? Is there somebody from Children, Youth, and Families going out to see whether they're doing their jobs? I mean, in this case, certainly not.
Yeah, I mean, there is a process. And the process is that when you are a treatment foster care company and you want to register with the state, you have to get a license. So you go to CYFD and say here's all my paperwork, all my ducks are in a row. Can I have my license? They'll evaluate and make sure that, you know, that you're complying with the rules and then give you your license. And then every year or so, as you need to renew your license. And in order to do that, you have to have a CYFD auditor come in and make sure that you're complying with all the regulations. So what we found was, first of all, there's only one person in the unit at CYFD that's responsible for doing that. CYFD said that's not a problem, that they're not understaffed, but a state like West Virginia, for example, with a smaller population than New Mexico, has 4 people in that unit. So we have 25% what a smaller state does. They have found consistently with some companies massive problems with complying with the safety regulations, with doing the safe home studies properly, with doing the courts checks, criminal background checks, abuse and neglect checks properly, with having the kids' records in place, like their medical records or their academic records or all these other things that you would need to make sure a kid was matched with the best family. The auditors have found consistently that some companies have not met those regulation requirements, those licensing requirements, year after year after year, but they've always recommended that they renew the license anyways, and they've always renewed the license anyways.
Why?
I don't know.
I mean, is there a shortage of foster parents, so they're just looking for a bed to put these kids in?
That's what some people say, yeah. You know, I asked CYFD, and they basically told me that they've been doing adequate oversight, adequate monitoring, and holding the companies accountable. But that's not what the audits say. So I don't know the reason. I mean, CYFD is under enormous pressure. You know, they're not bad people. They're people that want to help kids but have a really hard mission to accomplish at this point. There's, I think a record number of kids in need of foster care right now. It's almost 2,700 kids. And, you know, CYFD, they have their work cut out for them. So I don't know if it's an issue of just volume. I don't know if it's an issue of resources not being allocated where they need to. I don't know if it's an issue of just negligence and people not doing their job. But what the audits show is that there are violations happening over and over and over, and there's no accountability for that. And also, these violations that I mentioned, I think we found back from 2017 to 2015, we counted about 323 violations, mostly safety violations that treatment foster care companies had been found to have committed. 128 of those were for safe home studies, 28 for abuse and neglect, 38 for courts checks, 91 times where there were no kids' records or the kids' records were inadequate, you know, and so forth. And that's not comprehensive. That's just a selection of the audits that we got. They're not all of the audits. And within those audits, they only get 20 to 30% of the actual records, right? So they're not doing a comprehensive review of all of the records and all of the child's records, all of the employee records, and all of that kind of thing. When they go in, they're only grabbing, you know, a fraction of them, about a third of them, or a fourth of them. And within those, they're finding a lot of violations.
You chose the particular case that we've been talking about, which was this 11-year-old boy and his younger sister and this woman, Hope Graciano, who is now facing multiple felony charges. Did you also find other similarly horrifying cases? I mean, what does the sort of bigger picture look like?
Absolutely. I mean, there in the story, we list a few more just to show that, you know, this is not an isolated incident. And actually, Hope Graciano was not our original focus. We were going after another case that we thought would be a good representation, a good opportunity to see how things fall through the cracks. That didn't work out. And so we went to plan B, which was Hope Graciano, which I think was a pretty shocking case. But I think it goes to show that you can basically pick any case and find the same shortcomings, find the same problems with accountability, with monitoring, and with, you know, complying with safety protocols. There was one pretty notorious case down in Tucumcari, a guy named Manuel Preciado, who was licensed by a treatment foster care company. This was a now out of business company called Turquoise Health and Wellness. It was one of the ones that, you know, when Governor Martinez froze Medicaid payments to all the behavioral health organizations, this was an out-of-state company that came in and took over. But anyway, that company licensed a accused pedophile, someone who had been accused of sexually assaulting minors, foster children, and of giving drugs to foster children, licensed him, who went on to sexually abuse several foster kids in his care. And I'm speaking in these, you know, he's been convicted, pled guilty or pled no contest to a bunch of charges. So that case is settled. There are other cases that are pending. One is also against La Familia, and it has to do with a treatment foster care child who was sexually abused at home and placed into treatment foster care, and I believe repeatedly sexually abused in treatment foster care. There was a case against a company, I think in Albuquerque, where a girl with severe intellectual disabilities was sexually assaulted by her treatment foster father, according to lawsuits. I think that case settled out of court. And, you know, I found another case, a company called Family Works, I believe, who, this was back in 2008, who was placed in a treatment foster home with a violent treatment foster kid and was assaulted by that kid. So in all these cases, the attorneys claim that there were many, many warning signs. CYFD and the companies that were managing the treatment foster care programs had ample warning signs and should have known that these kids were in danger and missed the warning signs. And that's exactly what happened in this case with Hope Graciano as well. These cases that I just mentioned are ones where the foster kid or their parents were able to hire an attorney, take it to court, and see it through, you know, litigation. How many kids do you think, these are the most vulnerable children in New Mexico, most of them come from a low-income background and a background of trauma. How many of them do you think are able to get an attorney, relive this trauma, and try to get some kind of legal solution? I think it's fair to assume that those cases I just mentioned are just the tip of the iceberg.
What's in it for the foster parents? Are they after the money? Do we know how much they get per child, for example?
I don't know that number. I know it's higher than the money that you would get from just a regular state licensed CYFD foster home. I want to be careful here because, like I said earlier, you know, I'm assuming that most foster parents are really good people. I've talked to a bunch of foster kids for this story, former foster kids, and all of them said that they had at least some foster parents that were wonderful and that they remember so fondly and that it was sad to leave them. I don't think it's fair to just cast a shadow over foster parents in general. What a sacrifice to make, you know what I mean? To take kids who need help into your home and care for them and try to, you know, get them on their feet again. But it is true that you get paid a decent amount of money. Off the top of my head, I want to say the number is around $700 a month. I mean, so you do have a situation where you can make money by taking a kid into your house. And when that's not supervised properly, you can end up with foster parents who are in it for the wrong reasons.
The system is clearly broken. I mean, taxpayers in the cases that you are citing, and as you said, it's probably the tip of the iceberg, taxpayers are paying these people to beat our state's most vulnerable young people. And it's tragic, it's outrageous, the system is broken. I mean, here you have reported this, and it's been in the Sunday paper all across the state. What are the breakage points that you think could be fixed, and what do you hope this reporting might set in motion?
Well, step one is to comply with the regulations and to make sure that there is compliance with the regulations. That's not what's happening. You have a situation where the treatment foster care companies, or a lot of them, are not complying with their licensing standards, with the terms of their license, and then a situation where CYFD isn't adequately monitoring and then holding the companies accountable for not complying. So that's really the problem here that I've found through this story. You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't think you can say that the idea of treatment foster care is a bad idea. State foster care is not equipped to handle some of the needs of some of the foster kids, so it makes sense to have a nonprofit involved. I think that it's just an issue of who is paying attention to whether the rules are being followed, to whether the safety checks are being met, and what's happening when they're not.
Looking at it from another level of distance, and I know that this isn't what you're focusing on in your report, but I can't help but think that there's another layer of healing that needs to happen here in New Mexico so that kids don't end up in foster care in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I talked to a woman named Catherine Courtney. She didn't make it into the story, but she used to be Bureau Chief of Research at CYFD. And she said that really there's two solutions here. One is to have data systems that can actually track the kids and track abuse and be able to identify problems in school, in, you know, juvenile justice, in foster care, in CYFD, so that caseworkers can actually see what's going on with a kid before something bad happens. And the other is early intervention. If we were to direct the resources that we do to, say, juvenile detention or, you know, problems once a kid gets in trouble or gets into foster care, to making sure that families have the help that they need up front and don't get into CYFD custody, then that would go a long way, according to Dr. Courtney. And I do think that CYFD has moved a little bit in that direction. I think that at least their goal is family reunification and get resources into the family before the kids are taken away. But I think that's a hard call to make when you're a social worker and you see a kid in danger. In your perception, the kid might need to be taken away from their family just to get them out of a dangerous situation. Well, then they're in the system and they're wards of the state and they're subject to all the problems that we've been talking about.
It's such a cliche, but an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure is what we're applying here.
Sure.
Yeah. This is part of a year's worth of investigations that Searchlight New Mexico is doing, and it's all about child well-being in the state. Talk a little bit about that project, the overarching mission, and what your hopes are for it.
Well, our goal at Searchlight is to dig deep into issues of child well-being in New Mexico and figure out what is not working and what is, and offer the public some investigative reporting that can actually identify the problems in a really clear and concise way and an actionable way, and also look at solutions, also look at what's working in other states. It's a big ask, right? Because child well-being is such a big deal in New Mexico. I think our ranking, we toggle back and forth with Mississippi for things like child poverty, addiction for kids, all these, you know, high school graduation rates, teen pregnancy, you name it. So it really quickly can turn into kind of a situation of despair where it's like, oh my gosh, what can we ever do? We're stuck at the bottom. But a lot of times there are things you can do. Like in this story we're talking about, if nobody's monitoring foster care companies and they're not following the rules, well, the quick solution there is to step up monitoring and step up accountability. But we're also looking at things like education, Head Start, juvenile detention, teen pregnancy, a lot of stories just about raising kids in New Mexico and what's it like to be a dad, what's it like to be a mom, and what help is the community saying that they need in order to, you know, raise a healthy and happy kid, given all the problems we have with poverty and education and all these other issues.
It must have been tricky for you as the reporter to put all of this together. How did you do it?
It was really tricky because we're dealing with minors, and because we're dealing with an issue of child abuse, which is just such a gut-wrenching issue. It's hard to write about, but the problem that we kept running into was, you know, La Familia Namaste wouldn't talk about the case with us at all because it was an active child abuse investigation. The teacher, the principal, the superintendent at Animas Elementary at Farmington Public Schools wouldn't talk to us because they said, well, it's a minor, we won't talk to you. CYFD, same thing. We can't talk to you about an active investigation. We can't talk to you about anything that has to do with a kid. So on the one hand, those concerns are fair. I mean, you want to protect the kid's privacy, but when something goes terribly wrong like this and everyone says, oh, we're not going to give any transparency, everyone that had some responsibility in what went wrong says, oh, well, it was a kid, so we're not going to say anything about it. I think that raises some questions about accountability. It took a police investigation to break this open. And if it wasn't for Detective Blea at the Farmington Police Department investigating this case quickly and thoroughly, I say quickly, I think it took 3 or 4 months, but and basically closing the case from the police standpoint, we wouldn't have known any of these details.
Where are the children now?
We don't know for sure. We know that they're out of Farmington. They believed that the foster mother was going to come after them. She had made death threats against them, according to police. And so they moved them out of the area. I'm not sure if they're together or separate. One of the ironies here is that because of the contract that La Familia Namaste has with the state, that's the company that licensed Hope Graciano, there's a very, very good chance that whatever foster home they ended up with was evaluated for safety by the same foster company that put them into Hope Graciano's care.
One would hope that they've learned some kind of lesson?
Yeah, one would hope. I mean, it's tough because, you know, I wish they would have talked to me. I'm sure that they're not bad people. La Familia Namaste does a lot of work. It's not just treatment foster care. They do adoptions, family counseling, all kinds of stuff. You know, they've helped a lot of people. In this case, things just went terribly wrong. And in at least one other case, according to according to court filings, things have gone horribly wrong. So, I mean, the question is how do you get to the bottom of this when companies can say, well, it's dealing with a kid. We're not going to give you any details about what went wrong. I mean, nobody's checking, right? So I just don't know where the accountability comes from.
And that's the thing. These are services that one would think would be done by the agency itself, Children, Youth, and Families. And when it's subcontracted out, I mean, this is a problem that we have on so many levels across the United States, including on the federal level. What happens to the accountability? I mean, is it the same, in theory, is it the same accountability as if it were a government agency?
That's a really good question. I mean, I guess in theory, the accountability would be that the company would lose their contract to do treatment foster care, and if there was any criminal negligence or anything like that, then attorneys would get involved and press charges. I guess there could be criminal accountability. There could be accountability from the state just in losing your license, but I'm not sure how often that's happened. In terms of license renewals, the bureau chief that in CYFD that's in charge of that told me that she'd been in that position for 5 years. They'd never needed to not renew a license of a foster care company since she was there. And nobody could tell me when the last time that a license was removed or was revoked was. So, I mean, it doesn't seem like there's much accountability, just at least from what I've been able to see.
Ed Williams is a reporter with Searchlight New Mexico. You can find the story in the Santa Fe New Mexican this past Sunday, May 6th. And this also has appeared in newspapers across the state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we will be hearing more from Searchlight New Mexico. They're on the web at searchlightnewmexico.com. Ed Williams, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe.
This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.